This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most controversial issues in the Middle East is the future of the Israeli settlements in the territories of the West Bank and Gaza. The Palestinians do not want Israeli settlements in a Palestinian state. My guest David Newman says nothing causes as much heated debate in Israel as the future of the settlements. Newman has written extensively about the settlements and their history. He's the author of a 1991 book about the settlements in the West Bank. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post and the editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. He's also the chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. I asked Newman to describe the Israeli arguments on each side, starting with the argument that Israel should keep the settlements.
The arguments for keeping the settlements are obviously made by the settlers and the supporters themselves. And I would say there are two types of argument. First of all, there is a sort of a religious ideological argument which the settlers use to justify why they are there in the first place. They argue that the land in 1967 was not conquered or occupied, but it was liberated. It was returned to its rightful owner, that God gave them the land, and that this ancient land of Israel should be occupied by Jews and not by other nations, and therefore they have created settlements as a means of preventing any future territorial withdrawal from these areas. The other argument is the security argument. The security argument says we have to have the West Bank to maintain Israel's wider security, and that we can't afford to give it up to any form of foreign control, be it the Palestinians or other. And the settlers say that they are maintaining that security profile in the West Bank.
For the Israelis who believe that the settlements help Israeli security, how do they think they help it?
Well, I think it's true to say that most Israelis do not feel that the settlements contribute to security. The settlers used to argue that by us living in the West Bank, we prevent security problems taking place in Tel Aviv and Netanya and Jerusalem. And obviously, this has not been the case in the past 18 months with all the suicide bombers and so on. And even more so, the settlers who went out to show that they control the area, they control the environment, now find themselves completely controlled and besieged by the environment themselves. Their wives, their children are scared to travel on the roads. They have strong fences around the settlements. And in fact, the army have to put in extra troops to provide their safety. So in fact, many Israelis would argue not only do they not contribute to security, many would argue they're even a security hazard.
How in the minds of people who think it contributes to security, how does it contribute to security?
The people who think it contributes to the security think they're giving a sort of cordon sanitaire to the main Israeli population centers, and that by having settlements in outlying areas, therefore this prevents terrorism or military attacks taking place inside Israel proper.
Now let's get to the argument on the other side for Israelis who don't think that Israel should stay in the settlements. Why do they think that the settlements aren't helping Israeli security?
Again, there are a number of reasons here. First of all, there are those who are ideologically opposed to any form of settlement in land which they believe is occupied and which does not belong to Israel by any sort of sovereign or international recognition. They also do not believe that these settlements contribute to security, because isolated settlements do not prevent the incursion of suicide bombers or even of armies. And we've seen that recently with the bombings in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, Netanya, and all the Israeli metropolitan centers. The notion that single settlements could contribute to security was an old notion. It was probably relevant in the 1920s and 1930s when the earlier kibbutzim were set up in outlying areas. But of course, technology of warfare has changed, and an individual settlement does not really provide any additional security to the state as such.
What is your understanding of what the settlements signify to Palestinians?
Oh, it's very clear that the settlements, more than anything else, signify to the Palestinians the continuation of Israeli control and occupation. In other words, every house that is built or every settlement that is expanded is for the Palestinians some form of proof that they are not going to get their independence, because their land, as they perceive it, is being taken away by these Israeli civilian settlements. And so for them, settlements, more than probably any other single thing, it signifies for them that they are not going to get an end to occupation.
What do opinion polls in Israel now say about opinion on the settlements?
I think what you find is that opinion is divided depending on what particular question you ask concerning the settlements. There is, of course, sympathy towards the individuals in the settlements who are injured, who are maimed, who are killed by bombings and shootings, particularly if it's mothers or children. But on the other hand, I think there's a growing, I wouldn't say consensus, but a growing percentage of the Israeli population who say that if and when we get back to the negotiation table and we draw some form of future boundary and there is a contiguous territory on the other side, a Palestinian territory, then we cannot allow the existence of settlements to be the one obstacle to implementing that peace agreement.
Can you give us an overview of the number of settlers in the West Bank and Gaza and the amount of territory that they cover?
Well, if we talk about the West Bank and Gaza Strip without including East Jerusalem, then we're talking roughly about 200,000 settlers. That does not mean 100,000 families, of course, because a vast majority of these settlers are religious families, young families with many children. So it's probably talking about between 30 to 40,000 households as such, because many of them have young families and so on. Many of the population are religiously motivated and very ideologically committed to their cause, and therefore they've come to this area not because of any political opportunism or not simply because of the economic incentives which they have benefited from to build their houses in these outlying areas.
So, and how much territory would you say the settlements cover?
Well, each settlement on its own doesn't cover a large amount of land, but of course settlements have their planning blueprints which allows them to expand on wider areas of land in the future. And in fact, when in the past they've spoken about a settlement freeze, they've usually referred to the construction of new settlements, but not the expansion of existing settlements. In addition to that, the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip are planned and organized along the lines of municipal and regional councils, as happens inside Israel proper. And this allows the government or the planners to control much wider areas of land than those which are occupied by the houses themselves.
I don't understand why. Can you explain that?
Because what happens is the country is divided up into regional municipal councils, and the regional councils include within them land which is not part of the settlements themselves. And therefore the regional councils can in some cases have planning and zoning controls over the land between settlements and not just within the built-up area.
And are there Palestinians living in that land?
Yes, what happens is there's a totally dual landscape in the West Bank, unlike inside Israel proper, where the regional councils cover all of the people in the area or in the jurisdiction area itself. What happens in the West Bank is that there are regional councils for the Israeli settlements and a completely different parallel planning setup or framework for the Palestinian townships and villages. So there's a sort of dual space in which you have two parallel planning regional systems operating in the same space at the same time, and that obviously gives rise to a lot of conflict over zoning and planning.
David Newman is my guest. He's chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, and he's editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. He's done a lot of research on writing on the subjects of Israel's boundaries and the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. We're talking about the settlements. Let's look a little bit at the history of the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. The settlements begin after the 1967 war. How do they begin?
Well, they begin on a very limited scale because for the first 10 years after the Six-Day War, there was a Labour government, and that Labour government did not want to settle the whole of the West Bank. They were not influenced by the religious or the historical motivation, which the later settlers were. And they devised a plan called the Alon Plan, which was basically a security settlement plan in which the government said, we're just going to create settlements, the old type like the kibbutz and the moshav, along the Jordan Valley, because at the time the Jordan Valley was seen as providing the future security boundary of the State of Israel. But that same government did not create settlements in the interior areas, in the mountainous areas, where the vast majority of the Palestinian population reside until this day, because they saw this as being some form of a future agreement by which it would be an autonomous area linked to the state of Jordan.
How did Israeli settlers start moving into that interior area?
It basically started after the October 73 Yom Kippur War, when some of the more ideologically or religiously motivated groups decided that it was time to start pushing the government to settle in the heartland of the West Bank, particularly as they saw and continue to see this area as being the religious heartland of the ancient biblical sites. At the time, the government of Israel was opposed to it, but the seeds were laid at that time. And once the first right-wing government of Menachem Begin came to power in 1977, they then got the green light, particularly the Gush Emunim, religious nationalist settler movement, to move ahead and start creating settlements even in the interior areas.
So the religious nationalist settlement movement was a movement of people who believed that God had given the Jews that land and that therefore the Israelis should go and inhabit it.
Yes, they believed that this was part of the biblical divine promises to the people of Israel, to the fathers Abraham and Isaac and so on. And they saw the war of 1967, the Six-Day War, not as a war of defense or control or occupation, but they defined it as a war of liberation in which the land returned to its rightful owners. And once it was returned to its rightful owners, they therefore argued that no government had the right to give this up to any foreign rule in the future.
You say that from 1984 on, there was agreement in Israel's coalition governments to freeze all further settlement activity in the territories. And yet the settlements continued to grow. Let's start with the agreements to freeze settlement activity. What was behind those agreements?
Well, because settlement is one of the most contentious political issues, there are those, as I said before, who believe that you must have settlement in order not to have any form of territorial withdrawal, whereas the left wing in Israel and the Labour parties believe that settlements are a hindrance or an obstacle to future political agreements. Then whenever coalition governments were set up, they always had to find some form of compromise or agreement over policy relating to the settlements, because a right-wing government would have said, let's continue to build them. A left-wing government would have said, let's stop building them and let's not give any more resources to them. So the compromise which was made in 1984 and in a number of subsequent coalition governments was that settlements would be frozen. In some cases, they allowed a very limited number of new settlements to be built. In other coalition agreements, they spoke about a total freeze. But in retrospect, what has happened is that it only meant a freeze on creating new settlements, not on the consolidation and expansion and extension of the existing settlements. And basically, since 1984 until today, the settler population has grown from 30,000 to nearly 200,000, the vast majority of which has taken place within the existing settlements which had been set up in those early 1980s.
How are settlements handled in the Oslo Peace Agreement?
In the Oslo Peace Agreement, again, there was meant to have been a freeze on any further or future settlement activity. And settlement was one of the five issues, together with such other heavy issues as Jerusalem and refugees, which were put off for the five-year interim period to be negotiated and finalized when the final agreement was drawn up. It was very clear that from a Palestinian perspective, they expected settlements to be evacuated as part of the final agreement. From an Israeli perspective, it wasn't clear what their policy would be in this regard.
There was a survey published by Peace Now in March that said 34 new Israeli settlement sites had been built in the West Bank since Sharon was elected. How have new settlements managed to be built, considering that there had been freezes on them?
Well, I think it's a question of defining what exactly is a new settlement. A new settlement does not necessarily mean every hilltop which is occupied by a few tin huts and two or three families who are determined to make a political point, to sort of make a political protest at the idea that settlements will be evacuated in the future. I think it's very important to make the listener understand that settlements today are not sort of a few small huts or shacks on an outlying hill, but in fact are communities, townships, with houses and roads and infrastructure and services and schools and commercial centres and industrial centres. In that respect, new settlements have not been built. But in the sense of political demonstrations of putting up a few huts on a hill, this has happened whether the government supports it or doesn't.
My guest is David Newman, chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel and editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. We'll talk more after our break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Newman. He's the chair of the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel, and he's editor of the International Journal of Geopolitics. He's written extensively on the settlements, and we're talking about the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. What has been the role of Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon in settlement building? He's a former minister of housing in Israel.
Ariel Sharon in the past was probably one of the ministers most responsible for creating the infrastructure of the settlement in the West Bank. Particularly when he was housing minister, he was very positive towards the settler movement, and they saw him as an ally in their objective of creating as many settlements as possible to control as much territory and land as possible to prevent future withdrawal. So in that sense, Sharon would have a problem in evacuating or making an agreement which would necessitate the evacuation of settlements. And in fact, he continually repeats that any agreement that he makes will not necessarily include the evacuation, certainly not of all the settlements, and he probably would prefer not to evacuate any settlements. On the other hand, Ariel Sharon was also defense minister in the early 1980s when he actually commanded the evacuation of the Israeli settlements in northern Sinai, which was part of the implementation of the Israel-Egypt peace agreement at Camp David. So I think there's an ambivalent attitude here. I think Sharon is a pragmatist in all areas of policy, and should a political agreement be reached under his leadership in the future, which would necessitate the evacuation of some of the settlements, I have little doubt that he would find the means of doing so.
How did the evacuation of the Israeli settlements in the Sinai work, and is that something that Israel could possibly use as a model if they did evacuate settlements in the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, I think the experience of evacuating settlements in northern Sinai is the trauma that Israeli society and Israeli governments have about the scenario of evacuating settlements in the West Bank. It was a fairly violent process. There were demonstrations. Settlers refused to be evacuated. They even fought physically with the soldiers who had been sent to evacuate them. Although at a certain point, the settler movement decided, that's it, that's enough. If we go any further, we're going to end up with fatalities, and it could even end up with a civil war. And I think many Israelis, including the left-wing governments, are very afraid that if and when settlement evacuation takes place in the West Bank, such violence and such fatalities will be of a degree far worse to that which existed in Sinai in the early 1980s.
Are there many people, are there many Israelis moving into the territories now, or now that the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians has increased so much, is movement into the territories virtually stopped? Is maybe movement headed in the opposite direction of people in the settlements wanting to get out?
Interestingly enough, there's always movement into the settlements. Obviously, it doesn't take place at the same pace or rate that it was happening 10 years or even 15 years ago because of the security situation. But there are always a core of young, ideological, religious settlers who are making their first homes and who are prepared to go and live in the settlements. Most of the expansion of the settlements, though, are second and third generation settlers. Remember that the first settlers came at the end of the 1960s, so they already have children and even grandchildren who have been born in the settlements, who have grown up in the settlements, and are now making their homes as a second and third generation in the settlements themselves. There is a limited movement of people out of the settlements into Israel. They tend to take place from the less ideological core of the settlement movement, but there is a limited movement of people who are becoming worried and threatened by the security situation. Of course, the settler movement tries to downplay this. They prefer it not to become a public issue because they don't want this to turn into a mass movement of people back into Israel.
If, as Israel does pull out of the settlements, are there possible scenarios that have been proposed for evacuating the settlers and relocating them?
Well, obviously there are scenarios, because it is very unlikely that settlers of their own will would agree to remain in an area under Palestinian control or Palestinian sovereignty, and we would assume that the Palestinian state would not want them there anyway, and we have to be very realistic about that point. So there are conceptions concerning how the settlers should be relocated. And based on the Sinai experience, we would assume that many of the settlers will simply return to the metropolitan center of Israel, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem. But there are plans to try and build settlements in other regions, particularly in the southern Negev region of the Israel, which until today constitutes 60% of the country's land surface and only has about 10% of the country's population. There are still wide areas of undeveloped land there in which the settlers, if they had the same ideological commitment after evacuation, could in fact contribute to the development and the flourishing of the one area in Israel which remains relatively undeveloped today.
And it's undeveloped because it's desert.
It's undeveloped because it's desert. It's undeveloped because it is perceived as being relatively peripheral, although someone listening to that in the United States would say, what is a periphery in a country where you can get anywhere within 1 or 2 hours from the center of the country? It's not such a major problem to develop a semi-arid area today. You can bring piping, you can bring water, you can bring air conditioning. The major problem is to create the necessary employment infrastructure, which will enable people not only to build their houses there, but also to find employment in the region.
David Newman chairs the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel and writes a column for the Jerusalem Post. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David Newman, who has written extensively about the history of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. He chairs the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. He says nothing causes as much heated debate in Israel as the future of the settlements. Now, the issue of the settlements is very controversial, very important issue in Israel. Give us a sense of how it's dividing people and perhaps even dividing families.
Well, I think the best answer would be to say it divides my own family. I myself have a left-of-center political position. I believe the settlement should be evacuated, and I have a sister who's a West Bank settler. And we choose not to talk politics when we meet because otherwise it can become extremely sensitive and the tones can be raised. Clearly, it's a very divisive issue because there are those who see settlements as being the only means of preventing future territorial withdrawal, and there are those who see settlements as being the obstacle in the way of implementing any future peace agreement. And there are even those who say that had it not been for the settlements, then the Oslo map would have been a much better map, a more compact map, and we would not have met many of the problems that we have experienced over the past 7 or 8 years.
Do you think your family is pretty typical, that there's a lot of families that are divided like that?
I don't think it's typical of the whole of the Israeli population, but there are many Israeli families, larger families, in which political positions over the Israel-Palestine conflict are divided. You have right-wing and left-wing in single families, and there are a large number of divisions. I wouldn't say it's typical of the whole of the Israeli population, though.
So what direction do you think Israel is heading in right now in terms of the settlements?
I think that anyone who believes that there is going to be a return to political negotiations and some form of political agreement in which there will be a Palestinian state and a clearly defined boundary has to accept that on the other side of that boundary there cannot be settlements. Their settlements will have to be evacuated. Obviously, the boundary, if it is to be redrawn, may include some of the settlements inside Israel, in return for which Israel may exchange territory by the Gaza Strip or by the Green Line as compensation. But whatever the territory of the Palestinian state is determined to be, it is very clear that settlements there will have to be evacuated. And I think it is not just the left wing who see this. It is a very realistic position. It's not an ideological position. And I think increasingly people in the center and people even the moderate right realize that if there is to be a boundary in the future, this will be the implications for the future of settlements.
How have the suicide bombings affected your day-to-day life in Israel? Are you living differently? Are you taking different precautions than you did before? Are there places that you won't go that you used to frequent?
I think to a certain extent the suicide bombs have affected the daily life of many, many Israelis. In my own case, maybe that's less so because I tend to be rather blasé and some people would say even rather irresponsible in the way I think about these things. But just the other day, I caught myself thinking that my two eldest children who study in Jerusalem, they come home every weekend or every second weekend. And then on the Sunday morning, I take them to the bus station, put them on the bus to Jerusalem. And even I have started to get into the mindset which says, oh, I just hope they're not in the wrong place at the wrong time. They're not on the bus or in the bus station or the cafeteria that some crazy suicide bomber is going to come in and bomb today. So I think it has changed the mindset of the Israeli population. There are places which aren't frequented. Every time there is a bombing in a cafe or a nightclub or a disco. So for the first week or 2 weeks afterwards, you find that these places are empty and it takes time for people to start coming back again.
Do you feel like it's changed your feelings about Palestinians in general?
I think it's clearly changed the minds of many Israelis about their attitude towards the rights of Palestinians. You know, there are two arguments as to why the occupation should end. One argument is because some people say the Palestinians deserve a state. They're 3 million people. And just as the Israelis, we have our flag and our emblem and our anthem and we're proud of our state. So the Palestinians should also have their self-determination and their state. That is an argument which is very hard to sell today because most people have become even more hardline towards the Palestinians because of the terrorism and the suicide bombers. There is another argument, of course, which says that we need to get rid of the occupation because it's good for us, Israel, to get out of the territories and not to have to educate a whole generation, a third and a fourth and a fifth generation of young people in being soldiers of control and soldiers of occupation. And I think it's the second argument which is stronger today, whereas in the past, maybe the first argument would have been stronger. But there are a decreasing amount of Israelis today who are sympathetic towards the Palestinian political claims because of the terrorism which is taking place.
Well, David Newman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
David Newman chairs the Department of Politics and Government at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev in Israel. This is Fresh Air.